The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on January 27, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. I'm teaching a course on Nagarjuna in the Middle Way starting at the end of February, and I thought I'd just say something about that today, and this is my last Sunday before the class begins, so even though it's still almost a month away, but I thought I'd just say something about the topic of Nagarjuna and his verses on the Middle Way. So that's what you'll be getting today. I think the title of this talk is maybe just simply Nagarjuna and the Middle Way. Okay, well, today then, Nagarjuna's verses on the Middle Way. As a little bit of an introduction to Nagarjuna, this is basically what it says on the poster out there. I'll just read this. Much of it is a quote. It's quoting Kenneth Anada, who was a scholar of the Middle Way and Nagarjuna, and he's written a very good book, one of the good translations of Nagarjuna's Mula Majjhimaka, which is his masterwork. So that'll be much of what I'll say here in this quote. But let me just say this. So just giving a sense of who Nagarjuna is, or was, or is, still very much alive in his teaching, I would say. But this is what I have here. Nagarjuna stands out as the giant among giants whose teachings formed a foundation not only for Zen, but for all the Mahayana schools. All the sutras of the Mahayana rest upon his teaching. To quote Buddhist scholar Kenneth Anada, Nagarjuna's writings, though subtle and profound, carry such deep understanding that they will influence all or most of the subsequent Mahayana developments in India, China, Tibet, Korea, and Japan. His supreme position has stood firm for centuries. He was, in short, considered to be the second Buddha. I was quoting Kenneth Anada. And then I point out that in this course we will examine, the course that will be coming up now, we will examine the essential passages from Nagarjuna's masterwork, the Mula Majjhimaka Karika, which is fundamental verses on the Middle Way. I should say this too, that when I've taught Nagarjuna in the past, I've taken you through the entire Mula Majjhimaka Karika 6 times now, and that's a year-long study. Whenever I've taught that, we start in September and we'll run till May, you know, so for 9 months, yeah, we go through that. This will be done in 12 weeks, so it'll be somewhat abbreviated. I think for those of you who have had Nagarjuna with me, this will be a good review, and for those of you who haven't had Nagarjuna yet, this will be a very good introduction, a very strong introduction. And what I do, even though the class itself is titled The Middle Way, Plain and Simple, it's like my book, Buddhism, Plain and Simple. Some people got the idea with the term simple in the title that it's simplistic or something. Had a few complaints, not very many, but a few, with people writing back saying, this isn't simple, this is, somewhat difficult, or whatever they might be complaining about. Well, what I'm presenting to you is just simply what we have here in this teaching. The word simple doesn't mean necessarily simplistic. And same thing here with the Middle Way studies, the Middle Way, Plain and Simple. This is profound teaching, very subtle teaching, particularly that of Nagarjuna, where he really plumbs the depths of what it is that the Buddha taught, which is what I was trying to bring out in Buddhism, Plain and Simple. With that title, I'm just talking about this is the teaching of the Buddha. It's in plain English, there's your plain, and it's simply this. It's not embellished with a lot of other stuff that was added later and that sort of thing. Simply what the Buddha taught. Same thing here with the middle way. Of course, what the Buddha taught was the middle way. And Nagarjuna really points to this very clearly. By the time Nagarjuna came along, roughly 500 years after the time of the Buddha, developments in Buddhism, and particularly in the Mahayana, were developing in such a way that the teaching itself was becoming maybe kind of muddied or obscured in various ways, so that it wasn't really clear just what it was, what the subtle teachings of the Buddha are. I will tell you this, and I've spent now going on 50 years now, I guess, when I first started studying Nagarjuna on my own at first, and couldn't make any headway with it. It wasn't really until I met a teacher who understood Nagarjuna, it would be Katagiri Roshi, after spending eight years or so in various places practicing and studying with various people. Nobody seemed to really understand this, but when I met Katagiri right away in the very first talk he gave, I could hear Nagarjuna and what he was saying. And I realized I had finally found my teacher. What I want to say about this is that with Nagarjuna, I would put it to you this way, and I really mean this, that without an understanding of what it is that Nagarjuna pointed out, we can't really plumb the depths of what it was that the Buddha pointed out, or what the Buddha's insight was. Now, my friend Stephen Batchelor, for example, when he was here, he pointed out that he felt, and he's right, I think, as far as it goes, that the Buddha's concern was with suffering, the human suffering, which is correct. And I would agree with him on that. But in order to really get down to the root of what our problem is, living here as human beings, with a human mind, and with all the difficulty that arises from the fact that we can take our experience and throw it into conceptual forms, into abstract forms, and where we live almost entirely out of that, completely missing the actual direct experience of living right here and now. We really don't understand what our plight is, what our difficulty is, where the root of human suffering, what it is, and where it comes from. And this is what the Buddha was dealing with and what it's trying to help us with. And so I think Stephen Batchelor is correct in that his issue there was, the Buddha's issue was suffering, human suffering. How do we deal with this? How can we take care of this? But there is a great deal of, what it was that the Buddha taught is very subtle. And where we are confused and blocked and where we stumble over, the direct experience, missing it, not really understanding what it is, and allowing ourselves to get caught up in our thinking, in our believing, in our grasping, in our hoping and fearing and wondering and all of this, we miss the subtle truth of our lives that we're actually living out directly all the time. We can't help it, but we miss that. And so because the confusion that we have is so subtle, it's on such a subtle level. I don't really like to use that word exactly, but I'll use it for now. But it's so subtle within the experience and within our minds that it's not easy for us to understand when we have someone like this, like a Nagarjuna or the Buddha, pointing directly to what the problem is. It is true that in the Buddha's teaching we find a lot of teaching that is, that addresses the day-to-day kinds of things that where we might get hung up and where we stumble over, and just very practical information there. That is also in Nagarjuna. But Nagarjuna will bring us down to the root of where we are confused. And he does this over and over and over again in his Mula Majjhima Karika, his masterpiece, his masterwork. There's 27 chapters in that book, and every one of them has in the title the term pariksha, which means examination of. Every chapter is examination of examination of examination of examination of self, examination of the Four Noble Truths, examination of dukkha, of examination of movement, examination of time, examination of all aspects of the human experience. Well, not all aspects, perhaps, but by the time you get through that, you can start to see how he's approaching all of this. And what he's doing in every case is showing us directly how we're confused, where we're confused, where the hang-up is. We are hanging on to understandings and beliefs and concepts that we have, that we've constructed in our minds or that we've been taught from the way we've been educated, you know, in school or in church or wherever it might be, and politically, you know, and all this sort of thing. We're holding on to particular views. And then Nagarjuna will show you repeatedly that any view you take, any view at all, including a good Buddhist one, the Four Noble Truths say, and you grasp it, he will show you that immediately you have now embroiled yourself in contradictions and in confusion. And as a result of that, since it's a mismatch with the actual reality of our lives, we suffer. So if the Buddha's concern is, as Stephen Batchelor points out, the getting to the root of human suffering and pain, this is where ultimately where we need to go. So it takes us way beyond just the practical and the everyday, though Nagarjuna will bring us back to that in a very beautiful way. Brings tears to my eyes when I read that passage. But at the same time, he will point to the depths and the subtlety of what our basic confusion is. So this is what Nagarjuna did. And he, as Kenneth Anata points out here, he said, though his teaching is subtle and profound, it carried such deep understanding that it influenced virtually all the subsequent developments in the Mahayana, in India and China and Tibet, Korea, Japan, and it still is carried on today. And his supreme position has stood firm for centuries. In short, he's considered to be the second Buddha. Yeah, so he's highly regarded. His teachings as such have even influenced the Theravadan teachings or the so-called Hinayana. It has broadly influenced pretty much all Buddhism that is around today. Though very few people point to him directly or maybe quote him directly, but with a subtle reading of any of the great teachings that have appeared in Buddhism since his time, they all carry hints and language and the subtleties that Nagarjuna brought out. Well, what I wanted to say today, maybe I'll just pause for a moment. Do you have any questions about anything I just said there? Yes, Andrew.
Steve, I'm just curious. In presentation of your coursework, mm-hmm. are you using multiple translations or a single translation?
I'm not sure yet. Multiple translations can be available. We have those here from when I teach the full course.
Right.
And we can make copies of those. But I haven't really figured that out. We can make those available. Otherwise, I will recommend books you can get. But I will be handing out, I haven't figured this out, kind of my own rendition or paraphrasing, perhaps, of what Nagarjuna said. We have the entire Mula Madhyamaka Karika available in that form, plus little commentaries that I've given along the way. And I did this while I was teaching Nagarjuna. After one class, I just felt it would be helpful for the students if I would just kind of clearly state what each verse is in plain English and with a brief commentary of what I was saying in the class. And that I can make available. What I haven't figured out yet is, do I want to make the entire thing available to you? It's 50 pages by itself. Or I might pull out just the verses that we'll be looking at. And I haven't figured that out yet. Or maybe I can make them both available to you, but of course it'll be at cost, whatever that might be. So that's all I can say at this point. So I'm still, but I will give you the book sources that I have if I don't make those translations available. Am I making any sense?
No, I have those.
Yeah, I know a lot of you do, yeah. And that's one of the reasons I want to stick with all these. So, and you'll see what verses we're looking at, and you can always look them up in the different translations, whether you have the whole collection, the compilation that I put together for you. But anyway, so those things are will be available. I don't.
I think it'd be a challenge to take all those translations from a 9-month course and distill it into 12 weeks.
Yeah. So I'm not really going to attempt to do that, but I could do that with the summation that I put together for the courses. And whether or not I give you that for the entire, 27 chapters of the Mula Majjhimaka, or if I reduce it down to whatever. But I might not know exactly what verses we're going to cover, because I do wing it a little bit in the sense that I'll go where we are, and we're maybe it looks like we need more time here, and then maybe we could skip over these passages, So I'll be kind of working that through as we go through the course. So, the way I work is I don't figure out ahead of time, I nail it down, I freeze it out, these are the ones we're going to hit. I might be going different places depending on how things are going in the class, So for that reason, I'm more inclined to give you the whole set if you want to buy it. I think we charge $25 for it. I'm not really sure. But I don't want to spend too much time with this now. But I'll give all that to you before the class begins anyway. I mean, I'll know where I am with this, So, yeah. But I think a lot of you have taken the courses that I've taught before. So a lot of you might have the materials, already, as you do, Andrew. So, okay, anything else? Okay, well then, what I wanted to talk about today, I haven't used up too much time yet, I guess. I just want to read, because I don't think I'll be doing this in the class. I usually begin the course, the full course, looking at the dedicatory verses that Nagarjuna set out at the beginning of his Karika. And they're just two verses, really. But this is what he says, and this is what I just want to unpack for you this morning here. So this is the dedication that Nagarjuna left, saluting the Buddha. This is who he's talking about here. He says, I salute him, the fully enlightened, the best of speakers, who pointed to non-ceasing and non-arising, non-annihilation and non-permanence, non-identity and non-difference, non-appearance and non-disappearance, the dependent arising, the appeasement of obsessions, and the auspicious. So I salute him. I salute the Buddha, the fully enlightened. And fully enlightened, interesting term, because with enlightenment, it's either a matter that we see, we know, we realize, we understand reality. But this is an odd thing to say, really, because actually we all do. At least we experience reality directly. And in fact, I would say that we know it. It'd be impossible for us not to know. But we also conceptualize the experience. And we have a strong penchant, to grasp whatever it is that we conceptualize. And we will confuse that with what is actually being experienced, which is reality itself, and which isn't something that can be grasped. Reality, truth. But it can be seen, and it can be known, and it is known. And it, as I said already, it is impossible to not know reality or truth. It's all we ever experience. Even in our confusion and in our delusion and in our grasping, we are still experiencing only the truth, only reality, only Dharma. That is our only mind. As Wang Po says, there's only the one mind and besides which nothing exists. This is all that is ever experienced. But there is this capacity of the human mind to conceptualize the experience, which is a wonderful thing. It's not bad. In the way I'll talk, sometimes people confuse this and think that I'm saying that to conceptualize or to get an intellectual grasp of things or something like this is bad. or wrong. No, these things are very functional and useful, helpful for us in many ways. It's just that whatever we grasp there about truth, about reality, whatever is grasped is not the truth, is not reality. It's not even a poor substitute for truth or reality. And all human suffering, pain, misery, confusion, you know, fighting and groveling and fearing and, you know, terror, everything. And the ways that we'll behave and carry on with each other and bring all kinds of pain and misery and suffering, both to ourselves and to others, all of this comes through this grasping without our realizing what is going on, what it is that we're doing. And what enlightenment is, as Dogen will point out in his Genjo Koan, enlightenment is really nothing more than actually seeing delusion. So within the actual perceived immediate direct experience, which is known and realized by everyone, there is the conceptualization of it, the various forms of things that are appearing here within the experience, and we will grasp those. But that is delusion. And we see that that is delusion or we do not. And the enlightenment is in seeing and realizing what the actual situation is that we're in and not being confused by that, or we don't see that. And while the enlightenment itself, the actual truly seeing the nature of reality and how it is just this one thing that we either we realize this or we do not. And yet at the same time, there can be, because the world of the conceptualized world is spread out in an array of various kinds of things that appear to be coming and going and all of this, there can be depths of seeing through that. But that all belongs on the conceptual side. As a result of that, it can seem like, and as Norm likes to point out sometimes, our teacher, Katagiri Roshi, would point out you have these different kinds of scales of enlightenment, like just a little mini enlightenment. Or then he'd say, what, huge enlightenment and monstrous enlightenment, just stuff like this. Then there's also Anuttara, Samyak Sambodhi, complete, perfect, unsurpassed enlightenment, that of the Buddha. And so this, where he says the fully enlightened, what he's speaking of here with the Buddha. Buddha, by the way, is a human being. It's a human mind that suffers from this problem of delusion. It is a human mind that can awaken. It is a human mind that is a Buddha. A Buddha is one with the human mind. And in the sense that we all already have this immediate direct experience of reality and that we actually know it, it's just that we ignore it, in that sense we're all Buddha. But it's very easy for us, most of us are caught up in this, unless we wake up, to not understand our true nature, let alone the true nature of reality or the world or each other or the circumstances that we're in. And we're confused by that. And there's the suffering. But so the Buddha, then, is just simply one who is awake. That's what the term Buddha means, awake, or to be awake. And so a Buddha is a person, a human being who is awake. And in this case, speaking of Gautama, the man who awoke back in India 2,500 years ago, thus being called later the Buddha Shakyamuni, he's the fully enlightened one. Because what Nagarjuna is acknowledging here is that that man, who was 500 years before Nagarjuna's time, was fully enlightened, fully awake. What he's pointing to is that within his teaching then that we received from the Buddha is the full, complete teaching to direct our attention to what it is we need to, well, wake up to in regards to our own confusion and delusion. So he's acknowledging here that that Buddha is fully enlightened, understood this completely, and then offered these teachings, which in Nagarjuna's day were very confused. Because of the subtlety of what it was that the Buddha pointed out, many people were still entangled in a lot of confusion regarding that. And so Nagarjuna sets out to write this work, his Mula Majjhimaka Karika. But here's his dedication. So he says, "I salute him, the fully enlightened one, the best of speakers." And why would he have been the best of speakers? Because, in effect, having fully seen what the problem is with us, his teaching is such, and Nagarjuna really clarifies all of this, but what he's pointing to here is that in the Buddha's teaching, the best of speakers, because he points out everything we need to wake up to realize, to fully come to grips and to fully understand the situation that we're in here, which isn't anywhere near as dreadful. In fact, it's really not dreadful at all, as we might otherwise imagine when we're confused about all of this. But when we are confused, we are in a very dreadful situation. I mean, just look at the human world. Global warming and the whole bit, and disease, we're on the brink of all kinds of things breaking out, and war and corruption in governments and all of this sort of thing. It's a pretty miserable situation. And all of this is coming out of human confusion and delusion. But what it is that the Buddha pointed out, and what Nagarjuna will clarify for us here, is that there's really nothing beyond this. There's nothing to point to beyond this. If we fully understand what it is that the Buddha realized, and actually it's right there in your understanding now, you already have it in a sense. It's just that it's you're distracted from it. But if we can really clarify this within our minds, there's nothing beyond it. As Sun Tsang says in his Xin Jing Ming, we get to this point where there's no further. We get to where there's nothing beyond this. There is no further. There's no thought or conception to apply to anything now. And what he's talking about, we're at this place where we have a direct seeing and knowing of reality itself. We get to that place where there's no further, there's not another step to be taken. From there we can see what the situation is. So here he's saying the Buddha, best of speakers, because his teaching brings us to this point. And Nagarjuna takes us a long way in terms of clarifying just where it was that the Buddha brought us to. So the best of speakers who pointed to non-ceasing, these will be called the eight negations, so-called eight negations, but he pointed to the non-ceasing and non-arising, the non-annihilation and non-permanence, non-identity and non-difference, non-appearance and non-disappearance. So he pointed these things out. I'm going to come back to those in a minute and just take you through this a little bit more slowly. Then also he adds on the dependent arising, that whatever is here that seems to be appearing here within the experience, certainly we're in an experience, right? The experience we have now is of many things coming and going, arising and ceasing. But that all of these things, and the Buddha pointed out, arise dependently. They're all conditional, in other words. And then also the appeasement of obsessions and the auspicious. So this is what the Buddha gave us. With the appeasement of obsessions, normally through our thinking, I'm going to spend a little more time with that, I hope. But when we are still grasping, when we're not paying attention to what is seen directly, this is obsession. We're all basically, when we're still confused, we're all the primary obsession is just one thing. And I'll give that to you this morning. But it's just one place where we're hung up. And even though I'll give this to you, that by itself won't clarify it for you. But it is when finally this is clarified, is the appeasement of obsessions. And with this, the auspicious, you know, the, I don't know, the paving of the way for good fortune. It'll be the freedom from dukkha, in effect. So let's go back to these eight negations. So he says, so this is what the Buddha pointed out to us and what Nagarjuna will clarify. He makes very clear in his Karika. He gave us the non-ceasing and the non-arising. So he points to this. For those of you familiar with the Kakayana Gotā Sutra, there where Kakayana asked the Buddha, you know, people speak of right view, everybody's got a right view, this is right, that's right. Well, what should we think of as a right view? And the Buddha then, in other versions where he congratulates the man on raising a question in an area where there's a great deal of doubt about right view. Everybody's got a right view. So what's the right view? But if we're still thinking along the lines of grasping a view, or if we meet up with a teacher or a teaching or a system or whatever that hands us a view, and we grasp it, maybe at first it's like, I don't quite understand that. We study it for a while, and oh, I see. Now, if we buy it, then we'll grasp it. Even if we reject it, we'll grasp it, and then we throw it away. And this won't be the appeasement of views or obsessions. This is where we'll go with this. But what the Buddha points out is something different than this. What he's calling right view is not something that you can grasp, just as you can't grasp reality. Though we can see it, and we do know it already. But we keep looking for those things that we can grasp. Getting the idea, getting hold of something that makes sense to us. You know, and that'll, sure, it'll make you feel comfortable for a little while, maybe. But in the end, just where you've always been, the backdrop of your life is like, you know, what's this all about? Why are we here? Where are we going? What is this? And it's like a big mystery to us, and we don't know. When we are reaching for something and we can actually grasp something, that's where we will be, and that's where you'll remain. You might momentarily make yourself comfortable. It won't last because the backdrop of your life is mystery and confusion. But what the Buddha did here by pointing to the non-ceasing and the non-arising and the non-annihilation and the non-permanence, in doing this, we are not relying on something that comes and goes or that fades away or that is dependent on something else to be true, in which case now we got the same problem with that thing and on we go. This is a radical change from the way that we normally operate, from the way that we normally think and believe and grasp and form our theories and all of this that we preach and try to sell to other people. And this is a completely different way. This middle way. It's the middle way. It's called the middle way, by the way, because that term can be used in a lot of different ways. And people say, like, originally the Buddha meant, well, we avoid the middle way of, you know, living a life of opulence as opposed to a life of austerity and that sort of thing. Find a middle way there. Yeah, sure, we can look at it that way. But this middle way is right here with these eight negations. Is we don't go to either extreme in anything at all. And primarily, we don't go to the extreme in terms of thinking, in terms of is, that this is so or is not. And we learn to avoid this. And this is what it was that the Buddha pointed out. So with this, we have the non-ceasing. And when we get into the Karika, we'll look at this, the non-ceasing, that things do not end. But also the non-arising, that things do not begin. Even though it looks to us like everything arises and falls away. Yeah, I mean, like even something like the microphone here or the cup or myself or all of us, we're born, we persist for a time, then we die. And we're seeing things in these terms. We're seeing things in terms of, well, because we're obsessed over this one thing. Well, I'll tell you, I was going to tell you a little later, but because we'll get to it. But what is that one thing that we're obsessed over? We see things in terms of non-emptiness, as Nagarjuna would point it out, or shunyata is what the term he uses in Sanskrit. But non-empty. We see things in terms of substance. That there actually is something there or here, such as me. And we see things, and this is ultimately the big obsession that we have. An obsession is something that you continuously think about or that you continuously concern yourself with, the actions you take, whatever, over and over, repeating over and over again, making the same mistake or whatever it is, over and over and over again, or holding to the same thought, coming back to the same thought. What is it that we don't even really leave it? And that is that we see things in terms of non-emptiness, in terms of substance. And this is the deep obsession that we have, unless we wake up. And as Nagarjuna is pointing out here in this dedication, you know, he's pointing to him who points out, who shows us the appeasement of obsessions and how this might be so. And this takes care of the eight negations without us continuously running back and forth between the extremes. And this is called the middle way, where we just don't go to the extremes. But we don't go to the extremes not because, oh, I can't go there, I shouldn't go there, it's bad if I go there. You can't help yourself. If you see it and you believe it, you're there. There's no way you can avoid it in that way. The only way you can avoid this is by seeing the middle way, which is actually not some narrow thing. Somebody once asked Katagiri Roshi, isn't the middle way, it sounds kind of narrow, you know, middle way. And Katagiri Roshi pointed out, he held up, actually he was at a chalkboard, so he held up a piece of chalk, if I recall. And he said, how are you going to find the middle of this piece of chalk? He says, you see the whole thing. Now you can, if you're over at one extreme, you can't find the middle. It's pretty hard. But if you see the whole thing, now you can find that middle. So in other words, the middle way then is seeing things in totality. It is not narrow at all. It is seeing the whole. It is seeing things in their completeness, which you already do. You have this capacity. This is the knowledge that you have, the enlightenment, the awakening that you have, which means you are Buddha. Because you do have. But we ignore this because we're obsessed with the grasping of the various things that we think we can take hold of, because we think that these things have substance to them. So here he's speaking of the Buddha, you know, who pointed out, pointed to the non-permanence and the non-identity, so also to the non-identity and the non-difference, and the non-appearance and the non-disappearance. This world of this and that coming and going, it seems like I call it the world of appearances. I often talk about that. What I don't always mention is that these appearances, though, well, are just that. They're just appearances. So there's actually nothing there of any substance behind the appearance. To even say that we have the appearance. But then, of course, we don't have the non-appearance either, or the disappearance, or something like that. This is the not going to the extremes. This is the middle way. And in what Nagarjuna does here, he points to this, and I'm calling it the middle way, plain and simple, because he does it about as plainly as it can be done. But it is extremely subtle. So it might be hard to follow in that regard, only because we grasp. So it's hard for us to see what he's doing at first. And it certainly was for me for years. I had a hard time with this. But there was something about it that intrigued me and kept drawing me back to it. So eventually I realized what he was pointing out. But this it's subtle. Because we're so quick to grasp. We get the idea. We're looking for the idea. We think that he's offering an idea. Sometimes when I'm teaching Nagarjuna, the last few times I taught it, I've taken you through it here about 6 times now, the whole thing. The last few times I've taught it, though, I've noticed that a question that commonly came up in the first few times that I taught it was after we're into it a ways, we start in September, and by about November or so, people start to wonder, well, what's Nagarjuna's point? What's he trying to sell us here? What is it that we're supposed to grasp about Nagarjuna's way here? Because this is our usual approach. We're obsessed with, we want to get hold of this or that. We want to know what it is that I can grasp and keep repeating that in my mind as if this will be the answer. This is how we operate. We don't understand the middle way. which is really to see things in terms of totality. And there's actually nothing there in particular to grasp. And that's exactly what we have with Nagarjuna. He's not giving you anything to grasp. What kind of a teaching is this? That's why I'm saying that this teaching is radically different from any kind of teaching that you've encountered in school or church or anywhere else. Where the whole point of the teaching is to help you to acquire new ideas and beliefs and concepts and things like this, and for all their utility and whatever else, or injury that it could also cause, though you might not be looking at it in those terms, because we're confused about such things as that. But, and this is all very functional. In many cases, it's good and necessary. No problem with that. The only issue here is that as long as you stay there, you will never wake up to what's the actual nature of reality, which doesn't belong there in the world of the grasping. In the world of grasping, you just get some tiny little piece, and it'll be full of contradiction. You don't quite know what to do with it, and it doesn't appease the inner ache of the heart and all of this. It doesn't do anything, you know. It might obsess us, and we're driven with this, and pretty soon we're fighting with others who are upset. I mean, that's where we are with all of that. And it's just simply a matter. And it's not like, well, then get rid of all that. No, you can't really. Besides, some of that is helpful and useful, as long as you don't get carried away by it. Because the point is, none of that, no matter what you pick up there, well, will be the appeasement of views, where you finally can see the nature of reality. It doesn't belong there. And that's what this is an exercise in, is to finally help us to set down all of those things that you feel like you must hang on to something. At least I have to hang on to me, myself. But another aspect that the Buddha taught is that, well, if you look very carefully, you don't know what that word me refers to. You know, you think you do, maybe, but have you looked at it carefully? What are you exactly? You'll never get hold of that. You won't get hold of anything. Well, superficially, you say, well, I can get hold of this cup here. So I'm like, well, yeah, well, keep looking at that. What exactly is the cup? Everything will fade away right before our very eyes. I've just finished a book, which I try to help you with that, to see that no matter what you pick up, if you look at it carefully, it doesn't seem to carry any substance at all. Well, here's where we are. And what Nagarjuna is doing in this dedicatory verse here is just by the Buddha pointed out all of these things to us through the eight negations and also the dependent arising, that what does appear and arise here, it arises dependently on everything else, really. And so here it is in totality. In this, we look at things in terms of conditions, what are called conditions. I won't get into that here and all, but the conditions belong to the whole, which is we can see through the middle way. We're looking at the thing in totality. You know. Now we can see things in terms of conditions. But when we see things in terms of the part, holding to this part as against it, we see things in terms of causes, cause and effect. And as long as you believe it, and that could be a useful way to look at things. It's very functional in many ways. But ultimately, there's confusion. And you'll never settle that confusion. And Nagarjuna takes you through that in his Karika. But then he understands that the Buddha also, you know, this was in what he taught, you know, seeing through this in his dependent arising. And then also he mentions the appeasement of obsessions. And I guess I've already said enough about that perhaps. But the appeasement of obsessions comes with finally seeing things in terms of emptiness, as the term that Nagarjuna, writing in Sanskrit, the term he used was shunyata, usually gets translated into English as emptiness, sometimes as voidness, and even as nothingness, which is a wrong translation. It doesn't mean nothingness, and yet I still see such translations in English. But voidness and even emptiness have come finally to realize that was a term I mostly used through my career teaching this lesson, but lately I've been moving more toward using the word non-substantiality, non-substance. That's really what he's talking about here. But if we see things in terms of if we see things in terms of the non-substantiality of the appearance there, not the nothingness of it, because there it is. You know, how can you say the nothing? There's this cup here. This is not nothing. The mistake we have is that we think it's something. There's something there. It's over there. It's that distance. And you know, there's all kinds of problems with this distance and the time and the seeing and the atoms and the energy and all. You never get hold of anything there. You look at it very carefully. But clearly it's not nothing. But you want to say what it is? You'll never nail that down. So here we are. Avoid the extremes. That it's something. There's nothing. These ancient people who didn't know anything about modern physics and all this, that we'd have extra tools here that we can use to analyze all that. But if you just look carefully at what is experienced here, you will see this directly. And through the actual seeing of this and realizing that this is the non-obsession of views. Did I say obsession? Non-obsession. And Nagarjuna is saying that the Buddha pointed this out. It's very subtle. But if you could really see what he's pointing out here, this will bring you to the realization that is the non-obsession of views, to see things in terms of emptiness, or shunyata. And then he says, and the auspicious. And the auspicious, if I could do this justice, you know, it can sort of bring me to tears. But think about it. I don't know about you, but even while I was still a young man, I was to the point where, I mean, I looked into a lot of things. I became a pretty serious guy due to some rather sorrowful circumstances I suffered as a child. Some of you know about that. But really wanting to get to the bottom of things and looking into the different religious views, well, particularly the one I was raised in, but others as well over time. We're looking at the political scene. I was a young man. We had the Vietnam War going on. But just looking across the world, I got into the sciences. I studied here and there, kept changing majors and things and looking around. I wanted to really get to the bottom of things. I wanted to know what was going on. And it got to a point where it seemed like, well, there isn't anything. That this world is absurd. There's no rest in it, no peace. There's no justice, no fairness. And it's like nobody knows what's going on, and it's all just insanity and craziness. And you have this religious view or that other thing here, this political stance you could take, all of this. And it's like none of this brings us to any kind of rest or to some complete understanding. And sure, yeah, I was drawn to... I'd often go off into the woods by myself, up in the boundary waters, whatever, be alone. But still, here you are in this same world. If nothing else, you come back to it. There's like no place to go. But in these teachings, which I stumbled on, I don't know, stumbled on, but I finally found them as a still pretty young man, I could sense, I could tell they were pointing to something that was different from anything else I had ever encountered. There was nothing like this. And I was approaching it in the usual way, with the intellectual way, the conceptual way, getting the idea. What do you mean by this term? What is this? Trying to figure it out, which is the usual way that I did everything. It's just, but there was something different about this. Then, when I finally hit Nagarjuna, I really started realizing there was something here pointing right down to the very depths of what my despair was and what the confusion was. But Nagarjuna is pointing out that the Buddha pointed out the auspicious. The auspicious. Do you know that term, the auspicious or auspicious? It is pointing to, it's a word that's indicating that we're looking to something. Say that could bring good fortune, better days, something like this. And things will begin to work now because we have this auspicious sign or something like this. But this is the truly auspicious. Dogen Zenji in his at the end of his Fukan Zazengi, where he says, followers of the way, long accustomed to groping for the elephant. You know, the blind man, that's a Buddhist story of the blind man who meet an elephant and they're experiencing different parts of, you know, touching different parts of the elephant, this sort of thing. And one guy thinks it's a snake and another one a rope and one of like a pillar and, you know, all the different, the big leaf, the palm leaf or something, and the ear or whatever. Because they can't see the whole thing. They don't see things in totality. They haven't found the middle way in terms of seeing things in wholeness. They come to these different conclusions and they fight about it, and none of them are really satisfied with what they conclude. But this is where we go. So long accustomed to groping, so Nagarjuna says that, so here we are, honored followers of Zen, you're long accustomed, we all are, aren't we, to some degree? Groping for the elephant, groping, trying to understand what is going on here, what this is about. But the Dogen says, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, he says, do not be suspicious of the true dragon. That's the auspicious. Because it could seem, and it did seem to me, I'm just used to it. So you look into this and ultimately disappointment. You look into that, ultimately disappointment. This is the world. Ultimately, it's disappointing. You're not going to find the truth. But there were these teachings. I was fortunate enough to have stumbled on them, and they started to resonate somewhat with me. And it did give me the impression, the sense at one point, because I thought, well, okay, if it's all nonsense, then so what? But I thought, but if there is something to realize about just this, the world, I want to know what that is. And so I kept on going. But it was with finally reaching and stumbling on Nagarjuna that I felt this is a way that's pointing in the strangest way I'd ever seen. Pointing to something. Because at every turn, it was like, you're never handed anything. It's like, what? But at the same time, I felt like all this other stuff that deeply concerned me and vexed me and troubled me, made me angry and upset and all sorts of things. These things were dropping away. And then at some point, I finally saw what Nagarjuna was doing. I'm not trying to sell you anything. You know, I don't have answers here. Nagarjuna isn't going to give you. He doesn't hand you anything. He doesn't have to, because you already have it, so to speak. But what he's a master at, and he's giving Buddha all credit for this, but what he's a master at is pointing to how we're confused. This is what you need to find out. Because if you can see how you're confused, everything will be clear. As Nagarjuna says in the Karika, he says, for those to whom emptiness is clear, everything is clear. To those for whom emptiness, or shunyata, this non-substantiality is clear, for those to whom non-substantiality is not clear, nothing is clear. And that's where we are, unless we wake up. So this teaching of Nagarjuna, which Dogen was influenced by, Huangpo was influenced by, all the great teachers that we know from the past, the great ones, they could see what Nagarjuna was doing. And that's what we have here. And that's what is all I've ever, as long as any of you have known me now, this is what I've been, well, mostly, I guess, too far back. But this is, certainly since we opened Dharma Field here, this is the focus. This is what I'm trying to help you with. And here's a class now that's coming up that'll about as direct, I think, as we can go. And I'll do my best to keep it direct and clear. But that's what we're coming up with here. I have gone over the hour, so I thought I would end earlier than this, leave you time for questions, but I better quit. So. What did I? Did, oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry. Come to the class. I won't give you time for questions then either, probably. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.